Hello, everyone. I want to welcome everyone to our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting live Discord interactive podcast. This really aims to cover the burning topics relating to all threat hunting and security stuff that we want to talk about. And so make sure that you can join in the conversation, see some of the stuff we're posting in Discord by joining the Discord link for this specific episode. Just kind of kick off on introductions. I'm Scott Poley. I'm a senior threat hunter at Intel 471 now. But I've got 15 or more years doing cybersecurity everything. Love talking cybersecurity, love getting into it, love solving problems.
I'm Tom Kostura. In a similar fashion, I've been in cybersecurity for over a decade now. I'm a threat hunt analyst now here at Intel 471, but I've done a multitude of things in the security field. Really love this stuff. Always love solving puzzles. Love talking and working with the community. I'm excited to do the show today.
I'm Lee Argonaut. I'm a senior threat hunter here at Intel 471. I consider myself, I guess, for lack of better terms, a threat hunter, an evangelist. You can hate me if you hate that term. I get it. It's a buzzword. But cybersecurity for about a decade now, and I love everything related to event logs, EDRs, SIEMs. So just like these two, solving problems and looking at puzzles.
So today is kind of a special episode, something new for us. We're calling it our Guess Who episode. So it'll be a full coverage of a threat actor slash group where we walk through the behaviors seen by them and the behaviors of the tools and malware that they use. And we map those to MITRE techniques based on the data that we actually able to see, not just descriptions. So we're not looking at, oh, there was some reporting that said they did said technique. We want to see, proof or evidence of that. And so we did use multiple open source reports that spanned back roughly about 6 years on this specific actor. So we'll do our best not to give away the actor or group because we're not trying to make it super easy by blurting out something that's immediately tied to them. So we might be a little generic when we describe certain things or entities, but we'll definitely talk about the behaviors. So don't put any of your guesses in Discord chat because we want this open for everybody. There's going to be a link to a form that you'll see posted in Discord. That's where you should submit your guess. And you only can really guess once. So make the first one count. The first 10 to get it correct and fill out the form with information that we can send award to for getting it correct, well, you'll be able to submit those there and potentially win some swag. Now we're going to get started into the guess who. We're going to start at the end of the attack chain and walk our way backwards. So I'll be starting with impact. And as we talk and share, feel free to crowdsource some hunting ideas or solutions to some of the stuff we're even talking about. So if you have ideas for how you might solve this or what you might look for or any other interesting anecdotes, share as well. So diving in. To impact, something that you'll probably notice with some of the things we share, because MITRE kind of puts its behaviors and techniques in specific tactics, I typically try to call out the technique where I think the purpose is. So sometimes those don't always align what we specifically talk about. So you'll see some things that don't necessarily line up, but we'll be talking through it all anyways. So starting with impact, right? One of the hints we did give away, if you were following our post, was that this is a ransomware group. So everyone should know that if you were following our post for this podcast. So it's going to be pretty obvious what the impact is here, right? So one of the things that this group has originally done was really just more about disk wipe type behavior. So the T1561002. They used a malware specifically to basically destroy the structure of the disk, right? So that's something we've seen, something I'm sure if you even research that, you'll find the common tool that's been typically used for this. Not the only group that uses it. One of the other things they obviously do that you see a lot of ransomware groups even doing is stopping services, right? The T1489. In this case, they actually, one of the things you'll see is a pattern in a lot of the command calls is the CMD exe. Doing a command slash C and then passing something on. There's a lot of that and a lot of the behaviors that you'll see today. But they use netstop, right? Netstop is something they're able to use to actually kill services. And they also use task kill with arguments of the image name and then forcing it with a slash F. So I'll share those here in the chat once I pass everything off. And then the last thing they do, which is really common against all the groups, right? So we're starting with the easy things that don't make it easy for you to guess, is they inhibit system recovery. That's the whole goal, right, of ransomware. So they use VSS admin, which people are probably familiar with if they've been following ransomware at all. So this technique is T1490. They basically use VSS admin to delete shadows. They delete all the shadow copies quietly. But one of the other things they also seen doing, and other groups do this as well, is they actually resize the shadow storage with VSS admin. And by doing so, that's shrinking something down to a point where there's no practical amount of information saved there. So it's like a way of deleting it without actually deleting it, with potentially detections of things maybe looking for. So you're overall basically changing the max size. And the last way that we've seen them actually delete is using WMI. So they're actually calling WMIC.exe shadow copy, and then they have where, and they actually specify the ID of the shadow copy they want to delete. So using for WMIC shadow copy delete, like looking for that kind of combination of things from command lines, it's good to identify this type of behavior. And the reason why I start with impact is a lot of times if you're seeing this behavior, you're so far late in the attack chain, you might not get too much benefit other than the discovering impact within your environment for maybe systems that you don't interact with directly. So you might not know they were hit with this. So I will pass it along, it looks like, to Tom, who's going to jump into exfiltration stuff.
Yeah, so I'm going to hit exfiltration. We have a one hop here and then dive into command and control and kind of keep working backwards through the chain. So starting with exfiltration, you know, we really have kind of one call out here. So we're talking about this specific group, exfiltration over alternative protocols. So over an unencrypted C2 protocol. So this is the MITRE tactic T1048.003. And we're gonna talk about a little bit of a variant tools and things used by this group, but definitely not gonna give the name. We're gonna kind of bury the clues a little bit, let everybody kind of decipher this. So I'm gonna dub this tool used, or this function used, as Broken Virtue. So basically what we see here, really simple, the data exfiltrated is over TCP 4433. So really kind of embedding that unencrypted non-C2 protocol or alternative protocol. And then hopping up into the command and control side. And again, we'll keep working backwards. So we do see remote desktop leveraged. So failed RDP attempted connections from the attacker infrastructure. You know, one thing that's kind of, you know, an idea to look out for is see like those dropped RDP inbound from successful connections, like with outbound source IP equals the desk IP kind of thing. Then we go up a little bit, data obfuscation, so protocol or service impersonation. So again, dubbed Broken Virtue, they're looking at custom protocol over 443. And going to keep climbing the chain, clue after clue after clue. Exploited RCE, so looking at Bits admin to download. Let me see how I can dub this one. Let's dub this one Honest Probe. I'll probably come back to this one in a bit. So what we see here is a Bits admin transfer. Typically, you kind of see out of the Windows System 32 cmd.exe. Then you have the command Bits admin slash transfer, and then it points to the URL that it's pulling down. In this case, it's pulling down DLLs and other information. So what you're really kind of looking for here from the hunt side is looking for those command lines that contain Bits admin. It looks for that transfer for over HTTP with an IP address. It's pretty low scale kind of point there. We also see Excel macro call downloads that install MSI Mirror Blast. So basically, you see an Office product creating a .msi file. Moving up the chain, because there's quite a bit in the C2 area for these guys.
Yeah, so we have tools.
A lot of it. So one that is pretty robust across many different things. This shouldn't be totally novel to anyone listening, but We're talking about PowerShell commands ran in a hidden format. So like a PowerShell, you know, dash W hidden, dash EP bypass, and then the encoded command to follow. This is common. We talk about it all the time on the podcast. It's stuff that we see constantly. It's still super effective and always works. Moving up a little bit. So we have a PE file saved to Windows System 32. And basically what we're looking at is a file write. So a system dir, D-I-R, for System 32 or SysWow 64 with a JSON file in the end of that. So that's a good identifier of how you might be able to find that activity. Climb in the ladder. So back to PowerShell. So PowerShell script file create for scheduled tasks. This is also something that we see quite often. So really what you're looking for again here is another file create or file write for like a .ps1 in a Windows system directory. So System 32 or SysWow 64 again. You're going to hear this a lot. So just keep taking notes. PowerShell, PowerShell, PowerShell. So also you see the PowerShell download. So what we typically see here is an invoked web request call or IWR for alias. And it usually goes direct to an IP call. So when you're looking for that, you know, an IWR command followed by an IP address inside of that command, it's a good identifier for this.
Something to note on that I always find interesting is when attackers actually are storing commands in variables. And we mentioned, like, I always mentioned the single file named, or single character named files is like a big indicator. I always find it interesting. You always see the single character variables that are storing these commands. This is something about single character everything that always stands out to me.
That's a great point. It's a great point. And these, this group is not shy of using single character files. All right. So, you know, and inside of this, all of these, all the ones I just recently referenced were primarily suited under the MITRE section for ingress tool transfer. So T1105, just for note. You know, we also get a nice little flavoring of Cobalt Strike usage here too. Again, not totally novel to groups, but it does play for these guys. And then moving up to kind of the beginning stage or one of the lower tactic areas for command and control, we're talking about the application layer protocol, web protocol, so T1071.001. So here you basically, you're seeing that honest probe leveraged. We're looking at, you know, usage for HTTPS and HTTP, pretty typical, but definitely worth noting for clues. I think Scott or Lee, I think I'm passing it off to.
Yeah, I think I'm going to pick up. So, you know, we covered some of the impact exfiltration and command and control. So something I'm hoping that people will realize, like, those sections kind of cover pretty quickly. And there's kind of a reason for that, especially when you're looking at identifying threats, especially in threat hunting. You'll see where things really start to balloon within the technique, right? And to me, it's almost like that becomes like the sweet spot for where you can identify and potentially threat hunt for this type of adversary. But also, the unique thing is a lot of adversaries, you know, cross over into those like Meteor tactics. So it's just a good place to spend a lot of time in developing threat hunts and detections anyways, just because one, it's far enough away from impact, and also it's more tried and true shared techniques for you to identify there's something that you need to be looking into on your network. So to go into the collection piece, right? So
can I say something real quick? Yes. And I mean, if you think about it, if you think about how many behaviors and techniques are going to be used towards the to the end versus the beginning,
it's true.
If you think about the process, you know, at the beginning they're like gathering all the materials that they need, the information, they're gathering the privileges. So once they're past a certain point, they don't need to do much because they have everything they need, and now they're just like walking through. So trying to detect earlier on is 100% more ideal than looking for, you know, hey, ransomware note was just triggered and showed up on someone's computer, right?
I think it's worth noting too, the overlap with some of the tried and true measures. I think we're going to talk through them as we continue to go more and more and more. You're going to see those through a lot of the phases It's worth noting when you're hunting for these kinds of groups that those tried and true things, there is so much overlap for some of the basics. That's why you'll hear us echo them over time, not just in this show, but in all the other shows. So things we've mentioned so far, single file character or single character files, the use of PowerShell hidden commands, encoded commands, things like that. These are tried and true methods that you're going to hear that really are great points to Lee's point to be able to identify these things well before you catch that ransom note, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm gonna throw in a little snippet of the miter for collection. Obviously, collection is kind of one of those things where there's not much even in the collection tactic, right, as far as techniques go, but there's a lot of things you could do to facilitate those techniques. And that's something else, like we probably didn't call it out early enough, but sometimes as we're walking through some of these techniques, you'll see that there's multiple ways the same techniques being leveraged. And this is kind of why I usually have that problem with, oh, well, if you just look for this technique, you know, like, well, I need to know how, because everybody might have their own way of performing that action.
Yeah, because the technique can look the same, but it's more of the intent that's behind it. Like, what were they trying to do with this technique?
Yeah, like the leveraging of it. So there's really two main, like you can see in the collection. This is really data staging, right, for the collection. So it's local data staging in this aspect. So a lot of the data that they've done with the discovery stuff that they did with either collecting additional information to help them with future targeting or attacks, or even information they want to pull out, they leverage the directory, the program data directory on the C drive, pretty easy place to write to. And what's interesting here is they have created .txt files, CSVs, so they didn't really hide extensions very much. But they did create a .tmp file, just like a temp file. It's not really a valid executable, I would say, but I guess executables are things identified as temp, or we identify that as temp. But those are actually in the Windows temp directory. So they use both directories there. One of the things, single character files, right? So I talked about the single character variables and some of the execution stuff. One of the other characteristics, it's just that laziness of a lot of adversaries is, if they're just trying to move data temporarily and then use it or extract it, they just commonly name things single characters. So just knowing that file writes with single characters is just a really great pattern to look for. And then I one of the reasons it's interesting that they're going to the program data is it's kind of based on, if you ever look at attacks, program data, like the environment variables are commonly used within some of the code that attackers use. They usually use like the percent sign, which, you know, anything encapsulated in the percent signs is an environment variable. They either use the variable program data or they use the all users profile environment variable, which both now in modern Windows operating systems points to program data. So even archaic attacks kind of point to the same location now. So program data has become more of a place to look for some of these things. So that's with the local data staging. And they even, for some remote data staging, they did some remote calls and actually moved data that they profiled remotely onto the system locally. Same way, same types of files, same types of directories. But they also had a custom malware that I hadn't seen before. And this was interesting because they basically were able to put in the parameters for how they wanted to where they wanted to exfiltrate data to, which was the server that was going to collect everything, what port they're going to push it over. They even have some password protected stuff. And then they would target certain extensions in certain directory paths. And the directory paths they typically targeted was the user's OneDrive directory to see if anything was saved locally on the system. That way, their Outlook directory, which obviously is targeting email-based things, and then the downloads directory, which were, you know, three interesting places that were targeted. The download one, I think, is kind of weird, but whatever. But that was some of the things they did for the local and remote data staging. So the big interesting things, I'll throw some of the command lines for the custom malware. It's pretty, there's enough there for you to probably identify just from command line perspective. But everything else, you're kind of looking for file create behavior that, depending on what tool sets you have, you'll be able to identify. So I'll throw that stuff in there and I'll pass it on to Lee. You're going to cover some lateral movement.
Yep. So looking at lateral movement, the threat actor, they'd like to use a specific tool that was a very common piece of malware that actually registers a service. So looking at lateral tool transfer technique 1570, there's a hunting opportunity here for looking at Microsoft Event Code 7045, which captures services being installed on the system. Now, I believe this the naming convention is a mixture between numeric or lowercase and numerals, so or numbers, so that you know through some regular expression creativity you may be able to hunt for that. Also, looking at it, looking at the use alternate authentication material or a pass the hash, which is technique 1550.002. This is commonly abused using another certain piece of malware that is publicly accessible. And what you can look for is a successful logon, but not just a normal 4624. If you hunt for a specific logon type and look for the value of sec logo, this could be indicative of a pass the hash attack. Also, they like to use remote services, in this case, SSH, technique 1021.004. They used OpenSSH specifically. And looking at the command line arguments, they definitely made sure that they targeted a whatever remote port that they had listening, targeted at 3389, and then that command line arguments included the CNC server. So, you know, it was looking for Windows Remote Desktop support instead of a third-party software package, which was nice because, once again, these living off LAN binaries are things that they're targeting. They want to attack and target things that natively exist in the environment first before trying to, you know, add whatever they want.
So I think what's really interesting with that is I think they're actually tunneling through. You're using OpenSSH to, like, anything that bounces off that port to tunnel and forward it. So it's almost like port forwarding. So I think that's kind of fascinating that it's incorporated that way. And especially since they're kind of putting it under the guise of remote desktop, you know?
Try to, like, hide within it.
Yeah, like make it look like, oh, this is just remote desktop, and it's really just connecting and then pushing out by using OpenSSH's, like, tunneling ability.
All right, well, I'm going to...
It's heavy.
Oh, yeah, definitely, especially because it's a different way to use the tool, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm going to punt it over to you, Polly, for discovery.
Oh, this one's a meaty one, right? So we talked about things we get a lot more interesting as we work our way in. So one of the things we'll kick off is obviously every time someone lands in an environment, they're trying to basically figure out, well, what is around them? Like, what is it that they actually care about? And what can they leverage? And so what's interesting is, since they use such a large volume of malware through the past 6 years, a lot of the malware still did a lot of the same things. And that's what's kind of cool about some of these behaviors and techniques you're actually looking at as well, is when you're solving for some of these techniques, you're actually solving for more than one thing, even though we are focused, you know, theoretically on this specific threat actor group. So the first one is remote system discovery. So this is T1018. What's interesting here is they're leveraging ping, right? They have a few different malware and tools that are leveraging ping. And in this case, they're doing the argument with the dash N, right? And then they're only basically pinging everything they're trying to assess one time, which is okay. But it's always interesting because I typically do not see any Windows admins specify the dash N character, but adversaries do it all the time. So just looking for ping being leveraged with dash N is always just something interesting to look at, because they don't care about sending less ping packets because the default is 4 in Windows system, right? So they just let it run for those 4 and see if that passes or fails. So that targeted ping, easy to look for in an environment. Also good to be aware of that a lot of tools natively just kind of implement it that way. So another thing that for remote system discovery is the net commands, right? So there's a lot of net commands being utilized in discovery. So as I kind of mentioned those net commands as I walk through all this, it's good to also think about time-based kind of threat hunting or aggregation, where you can say, do we see a lot of these happening within this window based on certain counts and thresholds? Another good way to identify some of these things that may blend in with some normal behavior and environment. So in this case, they're using the net group and focusing on domain controllers. They're trying to get a list of what are the domain controllers within this domain that they landed in. And that's run through one of the malwares they leverage. One of the other things that's interesting is I mentioned the ping with the dash in, right, for the number of accounts. But outside of those tools, they've seen actually manually running that, but in a for loop, right, from a command prompt. And they'll do a for loop to basically dump everything to a text file. You know, when I mentioned those text files in the program data directory, that's them doing that. We're doing a single ping to every single host in the environment and then building out that text file to know, well, what's live basically on the network. And they also do that for hosts. And then they actually do a for loop to try and target servers based on the list they have to ping against to see what's live for servers. So that's just the remote system discovery, right? And then network share discovery. So this is kind of common. Even a lot of actors look for shares, but ransomware specifically because, or, you know, actors that focus in ransomware specifically because that's actually a place where a lot of data that you might care about is stored and gives you ability to move through the network as well. So network share discovery, which is T1135, that is where they do similar thing, right? They do a for loop, but they're doing a net view on all the servers that were in that server live list that they built with the ping. Now they're use a net view on that list. So pulling that same file in to do the net view. And what net view is doing is allowing them to view what shares are actually mapped on those servers. So that's kind of a way to have the host basically, you know, state what shares it has, share that back, and it's able to build a list there. And let's see. They also do a check for if they have admin share available. So this is where they're basically trying to do a directory where they're basically doing a DIR. It's a test of the directories there. And they're looking at the C dollar sign. So if an admin share, if you're not familiar with admin share, is if it's available, that's how it's kind of seen in the system. Back way back in the day when security wasn't really a thing, the way things were configured, you could actually get to any host by the IP of that host and C dollar sign, and you would basically jump right there on their hard disk and be able to navigate. So that's just kind of how that is. Nowadays, a lot of that's kind of locked down by default or can be. But in cases where it's exposed, it's a lot of access. And then you look at they queried registry for things. So this is T1012. And what's unique here is they're actually using the registry by looking at the hive key for users, and then based on their SID under the network path. This is basically showing what mapped shares are saved in the registry. So if a user ever mapped a share, I think it historically is there, but definitely the shares they're using are going to be there as well. So another way for them to get that shared information. So one of the things, like I mentioned, there's 6 years going back, and obviously discovering shares is a thing and it's something they care about, and they have multiple techniques for that, right? And then one of the things they queried for the registry for is they use WMI to kind of do the same thing. So they did a reg query, right, for the first attempt. And one of the things they can do from WMI is they can actually do remote calls to other hosts as well. So it's a way they can do it locally real quick and then do WMI call to do it remotely. So looking for those things. And then also one of the things they also queried from the registry, and this isn't an uncommon technique, but they actually exported the SAM hive and the security hive from registry. So this is a way where a lot of times actors are going to pull these the SAM and security hive because they'll have information that they can then later crack and get more credentials for things on the box and so forth. So there's some sensitive stuff in there, especially with credentials. So another thing they obviously are going to be doing in the environment, they've looked for shares. They look for what hosts are there. Now they're looking at process-based stuff. So they did use a few different, or they used a main attack tool for this. But basically, the attack tool lets them basically call WMI remotely And then they're doing the process get executable path. So that's just basically going to show all the executables running on that targeted host. So they're looking for maybe potentially security software, but just software in general is going to be populated back. Another thing that they do as well is they just run the task list. And then if you do a task list, but use the argument slash S and put it in an IP address of a remote host, you're actually able to run that and collect that remotely. It's going to run locally, but it's going to profile locally or remotely. Sorry. So that's a very unique way to use task lists and something to pay attention to, because that's not something a lot of people even run task lists for. But in this case, it is one of the methods they typically use. For software discovery, so we did process discovery. So for software discovery, they use a specific attack tool. And one of the things they were specifically looking for in this case was if Windows Defender was there. So they were actually using command prompt with the passing the slash C for a command argument and running PowerShell. So every time I always see script tool chaining is like what I like to call it. It's usually indicative of something not good. But then they're running the git-np computer status, which is basically saying is like Defender running or on the box. So profile basically for Defender. They also, you know, obviously you're going to really care about once they know the environment, well, who's got what permissions, right? What accounts should we target, attack, or look to potentially compromise? So they're looking for permission groups discovery for the domain groups. So this is T1069.002. In this case, we're really looking at they're using net, right? So net group slash domain, net group domain admin slash domain. So we're pulling information back to figure out, well, what's in this domain, who are the domain admins. So a lot of just basic discovery there. But then they also do the permission group discovery for local groups. This is the T1069, but it's .001. And they're actually looking in this case for net local group instead of group, right? For remote desktop users is the group or administrators. And those are the two groups that come up a lot, especially when they're creating accounts and stuff you might see later. They really do focus on that remote desktop users group and administrators group, which kind of makes sense because on a local box, that's kind of what you want to have so you can remotely get to the box and connect to it for persistence perspective, and then also have the correct rights. They do use a common tool for system information discovery, but they use this for more than just this, but they use this tool at 80find. It's a very common tool now I see a lot of groups use, but it's a simple way to basically run this queries against the domain to look for computers and operating systems, or you can look for groups, you can look for users, you can do anything you want to really query an AD Active Directory with this tool. And so a lot of groups use this tool. One of the big key things that I typically look for this tool usage is if you see command line arguments with the dash F object category and then some sort of category name that they may care about, or you're worried about. In this case, they're using computer. Good pattern to easily identify the use of some of this activity. Like I said, we're talking discovery here. This is a big chunk. There's still more to go through. So great place to be digging in. So hopefully, as I'm working through some of this, maybe some of you guys have made some guesses. But if you haven't, you know, I'm really curious to see if anyone gets it. So with account discovery, domain accounts, T1087.002, malware specifically was used to call the net user command. And one of the things to pay attention to, which I didn't mention before with the net commands, is when you see net commands being leveraged, sometimes you see net one. They kind of use in tandem and they kind of call each, I'm going to say call each other, but one calls the other. And the net one is really just a way to make sure that if there's any legacy-based things being run, it's still compatible. So if you see that behavior, it's not unusual. It's just kind of built in that way. So they use the net user to look for specific users in a domain, which is interesting. And then they used 80find as well for account discovery, but for email account. So when they do the object category person, and the specific things they called out were SAM account name, display name, given name, department, description, title, and mail. in that mail field is going to be people's email. So AdFind can help people enumerate everybody's email within the domain, and that's the t1087.003. And they're dumping that to a CSV. So something to pay attention to there. That's a great mechanism for them to collect information for them to use, you know, later on down the road, because let's be honest, people don't roll people's email accounts. So they just become persistent targets for future campaigns and things like that. Let's see here. Another attack tool that they use to kind of do account discovery is the Q user command, which it's interesting. Like, I see Q user used, I wouldn't say a lot, but basically it's a built-in Windows binary. It's used to observe and identify current sessions or logged in users. So sometimes if you're specifically trying to target privileged people and you know they might be on specific boxes you've landed on, or maybe you're just curious if someone has a session that you may be able to take advantage of, especially depending on how they have their system set up to protect credentials, as far as like dumping memory for credentials, attacking LSAS and things like that, it kind of preempts you as far as what you might care about. So seeing Q user being leveraged, it's not a very popular command, I would say, being used or executable being used in environments by a lot of administrators. So being aware of when it's used is good. Another thing that is a common discovery mechanism that's used by, gosh, almost everybody is when they do domain trust discovery. This is T1482. This is NL test, right? Very common command to use, usually do slash domain trust. And it basically says, what domains do you have trust relationships with? This is important for really large environments, obviously, too, to help them navigate as far as there are other domains they need to consider attacking, all those kind of things. And last but not least, the last discovery thing is they do the system network configuration discovery for internet connection discovery. This is basically a technique that is being leveraged to determine, did they land somewhere that they can connect out to the internet? So it's not commonly used by attackers directly. A lot of times malware and things use this. But from the instance I saw, there was no reference to malware specifically calling this. So maybe if they get deep enough within a network, they call this manually. But the technique ID is T1016.001. And in this case, they're actually pinging Cloudflare, right? And then just like we mentioned with pings earlier, they did the dash in, which is ironic because they did a dash in 3, which 4 is the default. So why shorting it by 1? I never really quite understand. And then there's a dash W, which may be wait. I'm not sure where the dash W3000 is, but I could probably look that up and verify. But either way, something that you can kind of pay attention to is a lot of times you'll see malware. If you look at malware reports and things, right, where you see Google pop up somehow as being connected to other like very well-known internet services. It's really good to build a list of those services, and especially if you see ping calling out to those services. I know admins do this all the time when they think they're troubleshooting internet and network activity stuff. But just knowing those common services an adversary might actually leverage to determine if they have connectivity, it's good to kind of have that list pre-built and understand some of those behaviors. And in this case, they're leveraging ping again, but with a dash in. So interesting insights there, right? So that is the discovery base here. So haven't seen too many people tossing any ideas on how they might address some of the things we've mentioned. I know we kind of been chugging through, but I think there's a total of 55 different techniques that we're gonna chew through here. So also, if there's any questions before we move on, if you have a question about anything we're talking about, if we hit something really fast and you're curious more about it, feel free to drop that into Discord as well. And we'll do our best to get to it and provide a hopefully intelligible answer. But yeah, Tom, I think I'm going to be passing off to you for credential access.
Yeah, just taking a breath before we start the rundown back. You know, it is always hard to kind of translate some of the technical stuff. So yeah, I want to echo what Scott said. Please, anybody, you know, chime in the chat and let us know if you have any questions or there's anything you want us to expand on, because we do have a lot of bullet points we want to kind of throw in as these clues. But stepping back to the discovery phase, Scott, as you were going through that, my mind was kind of burning on something that I tend to hold deep in my approach to stuff, especially when I'm in a given environment. And it's that know your environment, right? It's the understanding that while you see these things and we start talking about them, and from us as threat hunters, we want to understand how to identify the activity, right? So all these things we see, ping dash n, the net group, the net domain admin stuff, all of these things, almost everything you talked about in the discovery phase are usable admin level type things that will or could happen in your environment, right? And we see this, and I, Lee, I'm sure you can attest to this too. We see a lot of times where people will look for hunting something, they'll take something like this, they'll run it in their environment, they're like, oh, we have all these hits, or we have a bunch of hits, and we're like, there's this panic that ensues, or this level of almost over focus that ensues. And it's not to minimize the activity, but it's that know your environment. And it's always worth echoing that to my from my opinion. You'll find these things in your environment, and they may be just an admin doing what it's meant to do, right? Because these attackers are using these tools that are native to your environment, and they're leveraging them to great effect, but it doesn't necessarily mean it's malicious. So yeah, I just wanted to take a pause and throw that point out there before I start rambling off more bullets, and maybe see what you guys think about that statement.
Well, I'm going to cut you off real quick too, because I was digging into something funny that Pulley pointed out, which was the ping dash three, right? Or the ping dash n three. So not only did this instance, did they reduce the default by one ping, but they also, that dash w is for the ping to wait for a reply. By default, that is 4 seconds, or roughly 4,000 milliseconds. So not only did they reduce the default count by one, they also reduced the default wait time by 1 second, which, as Pulley pointed out, is kind of ironic. Like, why would you only reduce it by one? There's not like a significant change there. There's not a significant, like, are you really in that much of a hurry that you got to cut it down by 1 second? I don't know. But to speak on Kastura's point as well, knowing your environment, threat hunting will help you learn your environment. Tribal knowledge is one of the biggest hurdles that any organization can get, or that any organization really faces, because you have these like what we used to call the graybeards, who were your admins of ages past that know everything in the environment because they've been around for long enough. But what happens when you bring someone new in that, that's trying to investigate these things, and they say, hey, what's that? And then the response is, oh, that's normal. Well, why is it normal? How do you know this? Are you letting the data tell you? Are you letting hypotheses tell you? Or are you trusting the graybeards? Which, always, always trust the graybeards. But trust but verify, right? Go
Trust
and
but
see.
verify, yes.
Yeah, trust but verify. Because making assumptions is part of the game, but testing those assumptions is just as important. So let the data tell you what's wrong. I think I always like to think of it as like the hunter mindset. Ask yourself the questions like, has this happened before? Is this a common behavior in our environment? And just those two questions will really just start the gears running. Because if you only see it once in a data set of thousands of events, you're probably onto something versus something you see time and time again.
So I like the when you talk about like the weird activity, like that's how in some cases I think it makes it very easy to fingerprint actors or malwares, right? When they do some really weird nuanced thing, and then especially when you see that neat, weirdly weird nuanced thing again, and depending on some of the additional context, you can sit there and say, well, this looks like the same group or somebody from that group participating in this group, or there's some connection there, because sometimes there's just really weird things. Sometimes code reuse, it depends on where things are picked up at. But those things stand out to me in that regard as well. It's like you kind of aren't blending in very well if you're doing those weird calls or arguments.
And ironically, because we are speaking on ransomware, they're the ones that stir the pot, right? They're the ones that mess that all up, because their communication is sometimes better than our organization's communication, because they know what works. So they want to make that money. So they share techniques and tactics, which always makes it a little harder to, play the game of attribution.
All right. Well, I will kick it off in the next set of technical bullet points here. So we're gonna jump into credential access. So first thing out of the gate, we're talking OS credential dumping. So security account manager tactic T1003.002. So there is a well-known attack tool that's leveraged here. But basically what we're looking for is, or what we're seeing here is, you know, leveraging, let's see how to word this. I'm caught up in my words here. Like sysmon events for registry changes, you know, by source images of services.exe, as an example, or we're looking at, you know, file path events for sysmon source image svc host.exe file creations. There's some more depth to this, but this is kind of like the quick bullet points on this one. And then we kind of talk about OS credential dumping. So this is like LSAS memory, the tactic reference T1003.001. So in here, you also see, you know, pretty common tool being used, where they have a injected run DLL 32.exe with the target image, or the target being LSAS.exe. So this is a sysmon event code 10. And it's pretty much a rare process for LSAS.exe. So it's something that's definitely worth noting as far as, like, you know, investigating or looking to hunt into this kind of activity. Only the real two bullet points we have for credential access. So I think I'm going to kind of quickly get through my point and then toss it over to Scott. Looks like you get another meaty one, huh?
I know. So, yeah, credential access to me usually isn't that exciting, because either attackers nowadays have gotten credentials ahead of time through credential harvesting and phishing, or access brokers and things like that. Or, you know, they have, once they get a couple credentials and they get the right ones, there's no real more credential access really going on. So, yeah, that's always usually a dry topic for me. I usually don't focus too much on it. But yeah, defense evasion. So I think, if I recall, this section is the biggest section, and I think rightfully so. I mean, you look at all the different defense tools that we have, and they get deployed in different environments. So there has to be like multiple ways in which groups sidestep. So discovery is a big thing, because they don't really know what the environment is they're in, but they also don't want to be detected. So they need to be able to execute things in ways that aren't going to flag things and will make sure things will actually run. But also not get identified so they get pushed out. Because if anything, I've learned from a lot of instant response teams that I've worked with, is once something is discovered, if you have enough visibility, it's not too hard to root, especially attackers like this kind of class itself, out, like get rid of them. So, yeah, let's start from the top. So masquerading, match legitimate name or location. This is the T1655.001. So this is just one of those things where malware they used copies itself and runs as, in this case, runtime broker, right? Just a normal Windows process that you see by masquerading. Just it's interesting, because I feel like it might not necessarily trick some tools, but it definitely can trick an analyst or someone looking at alerts or details. Where, especially if they even saw a tool say, hey, this looks like malware, and you're like, no, I know what that process is, but you're not paying attention to maybe where it lives from a path perspective, can get you. Process injection, kind of a common thing that happens. The weird thing here is sometimes this is hard to see, depending on what tool sets you have, and a lot of things are done via APIs for process injection, but this is T1055. To kind of dig into some of this, one way to look at this is there's a lot of sacrificial processes that are commonly used. In this case, they do inject, they have tools, some of their malware injects into CMD, the command prompt. So it basically isn't the command prompt and it's running. To me, that's a good thing to look for, because you might see commands and things that get passed when that's running commands. or executing things that might be non-standard. This is where it's really good to look, you know, Linux, they have the man pages. I think you have the help or whatever in Windows. But it gives you a list of what arguments can be provided. So when you start seeing kind of illegal arguments being passed to specific common, you know, lol bins or window processes, that's a, kind of a good sign of injection. Like there's something running that isn't really it per se. One of the other malwares they use, they do this a lot, right? They almost use cmd.exe as a sacrificial process. It's basically saying we're just basically pushing things through instances that we fire up to get the executions off. So the other thing too is there is some one of the things they do to kind of process inject is they load DLLs. Interesting thing here, like I said, it might be kind of hard to see how this is being loaded the way they were doing it or where the malware is doing it they're using, but they're still using a single character named DLL, c.dll, right? So once again, just paying attention to how people act sometimes help you get ahead of, hey, this is a weird thing to see, what else is around this? And you might see some other telemetry to help you identify that, oh, this isn't good. So that's kind of what the process injection piece, based on the data I can see, the things to think about that they do. Account removal. So I did this for defense evasion. I know it automatically gets populated on impact. But in the case here, they're trying to remove the account that they put in. So I don't feel like that's really impact. I really feel like it's them removing an account they created. So, and promptly, within a quick succession from them creating the account, they did a bunch of activities and then they delete it. So sometimes just that time, the temporal time of something being created and deleted, something they'll be looking for. So I put that under defense evasion instead of impact, even though MITRE didn't like that. Then they also have the impaired defenses, disable and modify tools. So this is going to be very common. We see this a lot, especially the ransomware groups, in this one specifically, where there's a lot of targeting of Defender, right? Because I guess it's there's a lot of endpoints that run Defender. If a ransomware group hits, you know, maybe not big corporate entities, they're likely running Defender. So they use a few different methods. One they call the mpcmdrun.exe with the argument dash disable service. So that basically is executable for like managing it, I think. But they also, with PowerShell specifically, there are commandlets for mp preference. You can set dash mp preference. You can add dash mp preference. Depending on what argument you follow those commandlets with, lets you modify kind of the security stature of Windows Defender. In this case, they're disabling real-time monitoring. Very common thing that a lot of groups use is just adding an exclusion path, but in this case, they do an exclusion extension, which I found kind of interesting. So I've seen where people just exclude the whole C drive. So basically say just neutering Defender out of the gate. But this is interesting because they're not trying to get rid of basically everything. They just want to allow any executables that are to be run. So basically no executables will be scanned by Defender. So that's like something a little nuanced with this group that I've seen. And then they at some point in the past 6 years or so, if they weren't trying to just straight up disable Defender, they tried to actually forcefully uninstall it. So there are two different program file directories, but it's usually in the directory of Microsoft Security Client Setup. I don't know if it's any setup file, but specifically this one, if you follow the argument /x/s, the x is really the uninstall argument, and then the S is more silent, right? So the concept there is that they're just basically trying to forcibly uninstall if they can. The catch here is I think all of them, you probably have to have the right rights to be able to run things, but you definitely would have to have privileged rights to uninstall. Now, we're still kind of impairing defenses with this next technique, but in this case, I did put it under modifying registry because they're doing it in that capacity. So T 1112. This is basically they targeted all the main registry keys that house the configuration for Defender. So if you're not really savvy, registry is really the configuration of the whole system. So if you think about it that way, one thing that to note, though, if you don't see keys in there for software, especially on the Windows side, doesn't mean they don't exist. It just means that if they're the default value, sometimes they're just not visibly present. But in this case, these, gosh, I don't know how many keys these are. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 registry keys targeting Windows Defender that they're changing the values to basically make them true, false, disable, whatever. One, it's pretty easy to set up monitoring, especially if you've got Sysmon specifically on this these specific key paths. But seeing this many command prompt calling reg, you know, which is the reg.exe, which lets you modify, read, do whatever with registry, and a bunch of ads already within a time window span, that aggregation can spell out that there's a big change happening. If it's not from an install, it's really weird. And especially how it's being called. I feel like install wouldn't call this the same way. So that's something to pay attention to. Obfuscated files or information, you know, using encrypted or encoded files. I mean, everybody is kind of using encoding these days. And in some cases, encryption is still being leveraged. A lot of times I see the encryption on, you know, the network traffic, not so much locally. But in this case, there is some of that. So this is T1027.013. So encoded PowerShell command. You know, it's good to be paying attention to this because a lot of groups use it as well. But this group definitely uses it. And there's many ways for people to kind of shorten the encoded command. You know, they can do like a dash E, dash ENC. This group, in this case, from this reporting, was using the dash ENC for a PowerShell, you know, encoded command. Sometimes you can also kind of cheat if you're looking for the double equal sign for encoded command because it's usually base 64. But it doesn't have to have that, so I wouldn't die on that, but it's something else that might help you if you have a lot of noise potentially to help maybe root some things out, but it's not 100% there. They also, in one of their payloads, interestingly enough, and it wasn't tied to what I could find was specific, well, it's tied to the main malware they like to use, but they use triple DES encryption for the payloads that they're used that pull down and run everything. And this is only notable because if you have PowerShell script block logging enabled, you'd be able to see this. And it's not like they're using custom functions for this triple DES encryption. You know, there is the system security cryptography .NET class, right? And in this case, they're using that in multiple places. So they have the system security cryptography .password derived bytes. They have the system security cryptography triple DES, specifically, like we talked about triple DES encryption, triple DES crypto service provider being called, then the crypto stream, and so forth. So seeing these types of calls when, one, I don't think triple DES is as commonly used, but in this capacity it is for the malware. They're trying to move and unpack, essentially. So that would be a clear indication there's something weird happening. If you have script block logging, would you see this, I think? I don't think it's all run from a command line. That's why I think you need that. And then the other thing from an encryption standpoint, and I've seen this. I've seen a lot of groups use this too, especially when they're trying to push this via phish. But sometimes I can just drop these payloads. But they're self-extracting encrypted RARs. They're considered, I think the file is called an SFX RAR, or I think even, and it comes across as an executable. So it looks like an executable. But in this case, because it's encrypted, you also pass the X, which is, I think, to unpack. And then the X is going to be whatever key, the encryption key you're going to pass to decrypt it. And then the Y to say yes. And what it will do is basically unpack that entire RAR and uncompress and pull those files out of the archives. So it's a good way to move payloads in and not be picked up on because of the encryption. So there's a lot of binary proxy execution. So we'll talk through a couple of those. So this is where you're kind of taking advantage of some of Windows tooling, almost like Lulbin type stuff, right? And so this system binary proxy execution is MSI exec. So this is T1218.007 or 007. This is where actually from some of their phishing campaigns, when macros were more prevalent because they weren't disabled by default, they use macro calls to actually call MSI exec to download and then run the malware that they wanted to run. This is really easy to catch because it's usually got the MSI exec. There's the /i and then some sort of HTTP type request. You can go to URL. It's even fishier when it goes to an actual address. And then there, you know, the /q to make it quiet so nothing really pops up. The only thing unique here that I saw in one of the examples where I saw where they were doing this was the continue equals one. I haven't seen that being leveraged with this, so I don't know if Lee, you're feeling hungry to dig out what that means, because I didn't. But they're dropping this payload that they plan on running into the temp directory, and they're calling the temp Windows environment variable. And then one of the other system binary proxy executions is run DLL32. You know, adversaries use this a lot too. This is T1218.001. What's interesting is they actually use a tool that kind of help configure or manage systems called NSIS. I've never really seen it or used it, but they basically used a NSIS script to kind of help facilitate this. So like a native, you know, off the shelf kind of tool. But they use run DLL32. The thing they really catch here to make that more suspicious when you see it is it's actually being run from command prompt. So there's that process chain, right? You have command prompt running, run DLL32. It's actually running a DLL that's being dropped in the temp directory. Obviously, not the DLLs you expect to be run in that capacity. So that in itself kind of makes that suspicious. One of the other things they did for defense evasion is the dynamic resolution. They use FastFlux DNS. Basically, what that is rapid changing domains at different IP addresses for communication. There's some kind of data analysis you might want to do. This isn't necessarily an easy thing to hunt for necessarily without the right tooling. But I put it in here because it's, you know, something that I was able to easily see from data that was being done. They also use obfuscated files or information. So in this case, they use the sub-technique, the LNK icon smuggling. But basically, they're using LNK files that have command code in them. So this is T1027.012. And within this, the LNK is running command prompt to call MSI exec like we've seen before. But here's the one thing that is interesting, but the different examples that I did see this adversary using was sometimes they use the -i or -q, or they use the /q and the /i. And I only bring this up because some tools in Windows allow either way to call an argument. And so when you're building hunts or detections for things, that's really good to know ahead of time because it's really easy to sidestep some of those detections or hunts if you can change on certain characters and how it looks. So being aware of what works is good. In this case, MSI exec honors both. So you kind of have to build for both cases. And then they use system binary proxy execution with the ODB cconf. So this is something I had to kind of look up and research a little bit of this because I haven't really seen this that much. But apparently you can use the ODBCconf executable to basically then execute something else. And so when you see that, in their case, they actually did a -s/c-a, but you'll see curly braces with a red serve call, and then they actually put in the path, whatever it is they're trying to run. So typically, if I were to look for this, I would look for that executable, the ODBCconf, with those types of arguments with the -s and also the /s, right? It takes either or when I mentioned that before, the MSI exec, same for that. System binary proxy execution. One of the things that's really fascinating here is they use the control panel, which I know people have seen before. This is T1218.002. There's a specific malware they use that takes advantage of this. But basically, you can take a DLL, a malicious DLL, and you can rename the extension to a .cpl, and you can register it by adding that to the registry, which is in the current user software, Microsoft Windows current version registry directory with control panel and then CPLs, and you can basically add there. So if you're looking for this to be taken advantage of, being able to monitor that key path is important for ads to see what's being registered and see if it makes sense, especially if you see things from weird paths and destinations being added. Then Subvert Trust Controls. So this is interesting. Haven't seen a lot of this recently, but I know since we're going back 6 years, this kind of was a period of time where ISOs were being used a lot. And this is a Subvert, the trust controls for the mark of the web, right? So anything that gets downloaded from the web, depending on the file type, especially with NTLM file system, they will add a data stream that will contain data to tag things that were downloaded from the internet, essentially. They have the mark of the web to make the system determine if it should trust something or not natively. So this is T1553.005. And so this is common because this was ISOs being emailed in, and within the ISOs was a LNK file shortcut link with the same techniques to then call things when you run it. But it would get past any of the mark of the web type detections there. But there's like two things to really look for here when I look at this behavior. One, if you're able to monitor any kind of like ISO, image, VHDs, any kind of those like virtual disk type files, look at file size if you can. If that's something you have in telemetry and you can see those being created, if they're really small, it's really weird for someone to have a virtual disk really small, but it can be something that you can tell something might be being smuggled in some capacity. Also, if you see users executing things from mounted drives, essentially, like it'd be your non-standard drives, you might be able to see or correlate this back to something like this. Two more, like I said, this is a meaty section. When you talk about discovery, you talk about defense evasion, really big topics to really cover down on. Hopefully someone is drilling in on maybe some things that we've mentioned that help them narrow in on who this might be before we do a reveal. The last two here in defense evasion, masquerading, break process trees. This was just interesting because there was a Linux variant of some of their software, right? This is T1036.009. And it's just the break up the process tree in Linux, you can call fork, right? And in this case, fork's being called and the parent process is exiting out. It was a nuanced thing. I hate that I had to mention it in this part because I feel like once you get to this part, if it is ransomware, you're kind of late to the game. I don't know if you can really get ahead of it, but it is kind of a indication that weird things are happening. Knowing about this technique might be important because if people use this in other capacities, good to know. And then the most, obvious one that people are aware of when it comes to defense evasion, and that's indicator removal, clear Windows event logs, right? T1070.001. There's many ways to try to run this to clear. They use the most obvious way, and that is by calling web util exe with the argument cl, just spaces says clear. I don't know if anything I said stood out to you guys as I was walking through that. That was a lot to bite off there.
Also at the Windows event log clearing, there's also another parameter that's less commonly used that we didn't see observed by this threat actor. But instead of the CL, if you use SL, that's the log. So you could mess with the characteristics there. So if you wanted to disable logging after or instead of clearing the logs, looking for that SL parameter is worth it as well.
Right. Yeah. Like I said, there's really interesting ways in how people have leveraged that because it's very commonly used. And obviously, they're trying to subvert some like the pre-built detections on that.
Guys, check my knowledge here. But when you leverage the SL1, doesn't it allow you to shrink the size of the log file as well? So you can kind of manipulate it without destroying it, which might go unseen. And you can have that log roll over faster so the evidence trails off faster.
Yeah.
Is that correct, right?
I don't know if the SL specifically... It sets the limit, right? So I think you're right. But yeah, you can set limit to zero or set limit to small so it rolls. It's a way where, because it's a different log, right? And one thing that's, you know, people are able to pay attention to with the Windows clearing is if you clear the log, it creates a log, right? That says, mm-hmm. you know, the log was cleared.
Like 1100 or something.
Yeah, but like changing the, yeah, but changing the parameters, it might change, like, it might give you like an audit policy update or something like that, but it's not going to give you that clear event log that a lot of people track. So that's just a savvy way of doing it. I didn't see any evidence of this group doing it in a savvy way. But yeah, it's a good thing to note when you're looking at trying to create logic or detections hunts for Windows logs being cleared. It's kind of nice to group them all together so you kind of have that covered. There's definitely more ways to attack that.
All right, so I think I'm next with privilege escalation.
Fire away.
Yeah, looks like that's the case.
Or did I take your thunder, Kostura? Did I remove your name?
Oh no! You know what? I've been ready for a Lee Arcanol go for just a little bit. Bring the pain, man. Bring the pain.
You're gonna get two in a row because I got privilege escalation and my favorite, persistence. So this threat actor group, they also created accounts. So looking at sub-technique 1136.001, so create account, local accounts. The adversary not only created an account, but they also added this account to the administrators group and the remote desktop users group. And I think Poli mentioned this previously, but now that we're here, we can actually see what artifacts that we're looking for. Now, whenever you do, and the way the adversary did it, they used the net user and the net local group command. So, you know, that nice list that I shared with you for looking at what's usable with the net command. Here's a good example of two. So they used net user, and what artifacts you can find there is, first of all, if the account is successfully created, you can see an event code 4720. Then if you're looking at command line arguments, you'll be able to see the username that was created because it's net user username in bracket. Well, not in brackets, but it's net user, the name of the account. Then the next parameter followed is the password that's created, and then followed by normally a slash add. Now there are some times, because I've messed with this in the lab, I've used this, I would like to add this into our workshops, but you may also see slash add slash y, because I know I've been prompted about either weak passwords, because, you know, once again, it's the workshop. I'm not really trying to make anything complicated, but it'll say, do you want to use this password because it's less than 15 characters, yeah. It doesn't meet the complexity. So that might be a parameter that you might want to add on as well. Looking for that, once again, that forced bypass. But then once again, administrator group and remote desktop user group, because they're using that for privilege escalation. And the RDP could be used for persistence as well. Following up, we got create process with token, technique 1134. So they're stopping the print spooler service before deleting the service's registry entry for privileges. Then restarting it, allowing it to get default to the process token, followed by process injection. You can monitor this, it involves a registry key modification. So you can monitor this through either Windows event code 4657 or Sysmon event code 13. And then we have abuse elevation control mechanism to bypass user account control, or UAC bypass, which is one of my favorite topics because there's a ton of different ways to do this. In this case, we're looking at fodhelper.exe, which is a living off the land binary. You can look for the registry key being modified, which helps, once again, if you have it configured. But also looking at fodhelper being a parent process is a pretty interesting thing, since it's not really commonly used to execute processes and create children itself. Jumping to persistence, we got scheduled tasks, which is scheduled task slash job scheduled task, which is sub-technique 1053.005. They were so they established persistence on all the infected hosts they pivoted to in the network. Now the scheduled tasks were configured to load a certain malware using PowerShell. With the task created initially to run a certain, or sorry, said that. So they created persistence using the naming convention, which was a single character. Going back to single character everything, it was just a slash and then a character, which once again goes to show, you know, not the laziness, but probably the ease of use if you're going through quickly. And if you think about if they are doing this through command line versus automation, it's just so much easier to hit a key, but it actually deletes itself later on. So it actually leaves two artifacts. Not only do you have the event code to find the process or the scheduled task being registered, but you can also find the scheduled task deleted event code as well, which I believe event code 4698 is create and 4699 or in Windows native logging is the scheduled task was created or deleted. So instead of using the scheduled tasks .exe command or any of the parameters along with that, they use three different methods to create the to create these scheduled tasks. They imported the task or task schedule.dll or tskschd.dll. So they injected that into the process, which gave it the capability to create these scheduled tasks. And then once they were able to do that, they can run at system level privileges. Then they used obfuscated PowerShell, where once again doing the COM object, so the schedule.service COM object was used. And then finally the PowerShell commandlet. Now, the thing to mention with PowerShell commandlets is that if they're not nested in a command line argument, if they're used natively with PowerShell, for example, if you open up PowerShell and say get item or start process, those aren't caught in Sysmon event code 1 or Windows event code 4688. Those belong or will only be captured in PowerShell script lock logging. Now, event code 4104 is very useful with that because it will show you the commandlet that was used and the rest of the command. If it's all PowerShell commandlets, you'll see the whole script that goes. And if, say there is a PowerShell script or a .ps1 file executed, you can see the whole script. So PowerShell script logging, as always, is very, 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 very helpful and powerful when it comes to that type of activity. Now, I know we've been mentioning registry keys, and I know we've mentioned a couple throughout this process, and we also mentioned that you have to configure it, you have to look at that. But if you are using Sysmon, and if you're using even Windows Native, you have to have those registry keys either called out in the include section of your Sysmon config file, or with Windows Native Logging, you have to go to the registry key itself in regedit, right-click it, add properties, and then allow it to be audited. Now, you could go through and add some of the registry keys that we're mentioning here simply because we find them important. We have pump packages surrounding them. We've seen adversaries use it. But really, most EDRs, I guess, can capture the current version run registry key because they know that's abused a lot. But it's all about auditing. It's all about visibility. And that's really what it boils down to when we mention these artifacts.
Yeah. The one thing about registry keys that I would comment on is make sure you validate you have visibility because not every tool is the same. And this is where we've preached a lot of leveraging something like Sysmon for the gaps that your EDR tools do have when it comes to certain registries that are abused. So. You can take over again.
No, good call. And I'm thinking, I'm going to skip over one. We're going to drive straight to the next one because I've noticed we're running out of time. But I'm going to jump to another technique. It's still persistence, but it's boot or log on auto start execution. The registry run keys are start off order. Technique 1547.001. Now, this is a registry key I just mentioned, but it has the capability and the functionality that if you create a registry key and you put an executable scripting or a script file or something in the details of the registry key. Now, it will run once the computer is booted up or once that user logs on. Now, if you use the all users profile, it will run no matter what. But you can the HKCU software, Microsoft, if you drop it in that registry key, it will run no matter who logs on. But if you do target a specific user, then you have to wait for that user to log on. But either way, this functionality will just execute that. So if you think about an adversary putting a place or placing a backdoor or a beacon in this location to give you like that, hey, I'm alive kind of idea, that's what that registry key really provides the attackers. But like I said, also most EDRs are monitoring this location already.
Yeah, I would say the one thing I'd add there too is the user hive. If it gets added to the user hive, the one unique thing about that is you don't really need additional privileges to write to the user hive. Like any user can write to their own section of the user hive, the current user. So in a lot of instances, that gets leveraged because there isn't that escalation yet. And it's just an easy go-to with no resistance. So does that wrap up persistence?
Yep, I am done.
All right, so based on time, I'm going to move a little quicker for the execution thing, the execution tactic, right? So the top two are going to be obvious, nothing big here, but user execution, either the T1204.002 or T1204.001. That's either getting the user to execute a file, which is an attachment in phishing in this case, or click on a malicious link, which is obviously through phishing as well. The one unique thing here is because they use macros and things in a lot of their earlier attacks, if you're looking at suspicious child processes or lulbins being executed from any of the Microsoft Office suite, it's a good thing to pay attention to in this case, because you know that's not necessarily normal, and a lot of times that has been a lot of exposure to phishing. Let's see here. They also, they use PowerShell a lot. It's called out, right, with the command and scripting interpreter, PowerShell T1059001. We have mentioned this throughout, so I don't have to cover a ton of examples, but they did inject into like SVC hosts to create tasks to run encoded PowerShell. So when you start seeing, for instance, services.exe, which is going to be kicking off any of those tasks, if it's executing PowerShell or really any other scripting reference for other command prompts or scripting executables, that's a telltale sign to something to look for a lot of times when services is the parent. I mentioned the use of PowerShell by storing things in a single variable, so just not call back to that again. PowerShell, like the whole process chain with PowerShell kicking off, like I mentioned, services kicking off like PowerShell command prompt WScript. In this case, they use PowerShell to kick off WScript because they have a VBS script they want to try to execute. This is not normal patterns. That process chain is usually kind of suspect just because why, right? What's the point of executing? Why would you have to do something in WScript that you wouldn't just do natively in PowerShell? A lot of times that's a way to get around a lot of things there. And then inter-process communication. So obviously, depending on what malware tools or what malware is dropped, there's a lot of times where pipes are being created. Syspawn has the ability to log pipes. In this case, we did mention Cobalt Strike earlier. So there's a default pipe name for that. They didn't really go above and beyond to change. But something to pay attention to, a lot of times pipes are supposed to have normal names or normal looking names. So if you do have telemetry that shows pipes and they have like random looking names, it's kind of worth looking at what executables are associated with those. Schedule tasks and jobs. We talked about how they use a lot of scheduled tasks and jobs. At this point where one of the attack tools specifically will use either services.exe or svchost.exe, because sometimes svchost will kick off tasks versus the services that are created. But the child process of those will be something like command prompt or PowerShell. In this case, they use command prompt specifically. The the one interesting thing with one of the malwares they did use was instead of using the run always run, they use the run once, right? Which is interesting because it deletes itself from registry, but then part of the malware once it runs is they're at itself back. So seeing behavior over time like that is very suspect. But even when they're in their run once, if you were to look at the actual entry, they're using run DLL32, calling on a DLL to then do other types of things with regserve and other things. So very suspicious looking in general. And they're actually the file they're calling on with a lot of those executions is in the app data local temp directory, which also isn't normal. So worth paying attention to there. So I think I chewed through most of the execution stuff there, kind of quick, but wanted to make sure to get through all that. And then I guess Tom will pass off to probably the easiest thing in the place that's probably a lot harder to hunt with in general, but the initial access.
Yeah, so talking initial access, because it's really the last one in this group's attack chain here. Well, the first one, really. But it always comes down to that good old phishing link and the phishing attachments, right? So when we're looking at some of this, where you might be able to either consider the activity and or you might have telemetry depending on your tool sets to be able to identify some of these things. So really quickly, you know, when we're looking at spear phishing links, so tactic T1566.002, you know, links to download an exe looking like a PDF, URL landing pages that redirect to something like an Excel file, URLs directly linking to an Excel file. And then you look over at the spear phishing side, you know, we're looking at a XLS attachment with macro to download and run an MSI file, clearly suspicious. An HTML attachment that links to download another Excel file, you know, .rar, .zip attachments, .iso attachments. These ones are pretty low hanging fruit in my opinion. Shouldn't see a lot of ISOs emailed, but it's funny how that's still leveraged. .doc or .pb or .wiz attachments that contain a macro. So these are some of the things that you can consider when you're looking at initial access to see have they gotten in the door kind of thing. We don't have any pieces here for reconnaissance, so that kind of ends our attack chain pieces here. So I kind of hand it up to you, Scott.
Yeah, I was going to say what's fascinating there just with the phishing thing is over 6 years you can see how they used a bunch of different ways to try to enable almost the same technique. Right. Mm-hmm. And that's how I think threat actors typically operate. They want to keep using what they know and what they think still will work, and they might change the flavor of it. So that's why threat hunting becomes a core piece. Now, we covered 55 total tactics. The cool thing is, before we even dug into any of this, based on just studying adversaries in general, we already had 34 hunt packs that covered almost all the techniques, about 62% right out of the gate. That's why threat hunting is so effective. Even like going back and looking at things, we can see that this group, just for some metrics on this group, they did exploit over 13 total vulnerabilities they leveraged over the course of their attacks. And then from a malware or tool perspective, they used 31 total malware tools, 23 were malwares, 8 were tools, just so you can understand the breadth of some of the things we covered based on the data there. And we kind of pulled really only from 16 open source type of reporting. And the group for the final reveal has 13 different aliases. So quickly put in your submissions now if you haven't already. Hopefully this was a really deep insight to like all the different aspects of how this actor has worked over time. But the group is, you know, candid drum roll please, is Clop Ransomware. So it's the Clop Ransomware group, or a lot of people refer to them commonly as TA-505. But yeah, so hopefully someone was able to get that or guess that. Hopefully some of the details we provided either help people quickly research and find those. So really enjoyed this episode. Hopefully there's some feedback that you guys can provide. We'd love to hear it if this was technical enough, because we know a lot of people want us to be technical. So I just want to thank everyone for joining. Love talking with shop friends and colleagues. Check us out on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, just about anywhere else you get podcasts. Leave a good review to help others discover us. And if you don't know about our weekly segment, we also typically try to do a weekly 30 to 45 minute review on just threat intel in general and things you should be doing with it. So with that, happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everybody.
Take care, everyone.